Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
This is John Rappaport, sitting in for Dr. Bregan for a few minutes. He's been delayed on the road. I will be his guest today on the show, and actually I'll be interviewing him. So it all works out. We're going to be talking about, of course, psychiatric issues, about false science, the cultural implications and spillover of psychiatry into society. And I thought I'd begin, before Dr. Bregan arrives, with a quote from a PBS Frontline series special, an episode called Does ADHD Exist? The PBS Frontline interviewer asks Dr. Russell Barkley, professor of psychiatry and neurology at the University of Massachusetts Medical Center, skeptics say there's no biological marker, that it, ADHD, is the one condition out there where there is no blood test and that no one knows what causes it. And then Barkley responds, that's tremendously naive and it shows a great deal of illiteracy about science and about the mental health professions. A disorder doesn't have to have a blood test to be valid. If that were the case, all mental disorders would be invalid. There is no lab test for any mental disorder right now in our science. That doesn't make them invalid. That is an incredibly stark statement and a bald admission that, in fact, there is no science connected to this. Dr. Barkley is spinning, but he's not spinning in any kind of productive direction. Again, I want to read a couple of sentences from his answer. A disorder doesn't have to have a blood test to be valid. If that were the case, all mental disorders would be invalid. There is no lab test for any mental disorder right now in our science. So he's not just talking about blood tests here. He's talking about any kind of test. That would be urine test, blood test, saliva test, hair test, brain scan, genetic test. There is no lab test for any mental disorder right now in our science. So that means that it's not science. Now, he wants to expand into some unknown area the idea of science, when he says it shows a great deal of illiteracy about science and the mental health professions, but he's wrong. The obvious truth is, when you are developing science, and especially in the medical field, you have to make diagnoses. And if you're making diagnoses, there have to be tests. Otherwise, you're admitting that this isn't any kind of physical science. It's something else. Now, we know that the famed Bible of the psychiatric profession, which is published in new editions occasionally by the American Psychiatric Association, called the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, contains approximately 300 distinct and separate and labeled mental disorders. And there are criteria for diagnosis for each one. So what Barkley is saying, and this would include everything from schizophrenia to bipolar to ADHD, what Barkley is saying is that in none of these criteria for diagnosis is there any defining laboratory test of any kind. So then the natural question becomes, well, in that case, how are these criteria for diagnoses developed? On what basis? And it turns out that this is all done by committee. Committees of so-called psychiatric experts who sit down with what amounts to menus of human behaviors, fiddled in his seat in school, expressed boredom, looked out the window repetitively, felt sad, etc., etc., etc. They look over these menus of human behavior and thought, and they cluster some of them together, and they put a label on it, which is called a mental disorder, and they give it a name. So this turns out to be a completely arbitrary kind of diagnosis of all so-called mental disorders. Now, if you talk to researchers in the field and psychiatrists in practice, most of them, they will do a tap dance and say, well, we're learning more all the time. We're compiling more evidence for the existence and definition of these disorders. The evidence is overwhelming, et cetera, et cetera. But in fact, that's not the case. Because if it were the case, think of it this way. If you were publishing a complete manual on how to diagnose mental disorders, and you had a blood test, for example, that was able to yield results that were unique to a certain set of patients who had the same precise symptoms, would you not include the details of that test in the definition of the mental disorder or in the diagnostic criteria? Of course you would, but it's not there. It's not there for any of the so-called mental disorders. There is no lab test for any mental disorder right now in our science. That's what Barclay says. And he is simply echoing an open secret in the profession, in the press, and now in the public, that this entire arena called psychiatry is actually a pseudoscience. If it were just a game, if it were just a charade, if people were simply going into psychiatrists' offices or bringing in their children and words were exchanged and so on and so forth, that would be bad enough. But of course, that's just the beginning of the story, because following each diagnosis, based on no science at all, there are the drugs. There are the toxic drugs. And just to give you a little personal history, I've been working as an investigative reporter for the last 30 years. I met Peter Bragan a long time ago, and I was introduced to him by his landmark book, I believe. The publication date was 1991, St. Martin's Press, Toxic Psychiatry, which I urge everyone to buy, read, hold on to, save, revisit. A classic. Dr. Bragan goes over the drugs, the classes of drugs, and their effects. Their incredibly deleterious and toxic effects on patients. Drugs which are prescribed after the pseudoscientific diagnosis. Drugs, for example, like the neuroleptics, sometimes called antipsychotics, sometimes called major tranquilizers. The first of which was Thorazine. Now, these drugs can and do cause motor brain damage, sometimes called tardive dyskinesia or tardive akathisia. Motor brain damage is exactly what it sounds like. destructive of a life, destructive of a person. But these drugs are given, new ones are developed all the time. They are spread out over the landscape. And Dr. Bragan actually had a television debate about the effects of these neuroleptics many years ago. And on the very conservative side, you would say there are 300,000 cases of motor brain damage as a result of neuroleptic drugs. The actual figures by this time must be much higher than that. And that's just one class of drugs. The press and the public is now alert to the fact that the so-called SSRI antidepressants like Prozac, Paxil, Zoloft can and do cause violent behavior, such as suicide and homicide. And if you go to a website called SSRI Stories, you can find list after list of published accounts of the link between these drugs and violent events. You can also find studies. The drugs have been known for a very long time to cause violent behavior. So it isn't just a word game here that we're talking about, and the fact that psychiatrists have no basis for diagnosing mental disorders, no scientific basis. The drugs follow the diagnoses, and then the toxic and destructive effects follow. As Dr. Bragan once told me, and I've confirmed in interviews with people, you will sometimes get a pattern like this. A child is brought into a psychiatrist's office. The psychiatrist, after an interview, either with the child or the parent or both, decides that the child's behaviors do in fact fit this fictional pattern called ADHD. And then a drug like Ritalin or Adderall, which are forms of speed, are prescribed. Sooner or later, a speed crash occurs. The child is now sad, isolated, and so forth. Parent brings the child back to the psychiatrist, who now says, well, what we're seeing here is the emergence of a new condition, clinical depression. Well, the parent says, could this be connected to the drugs that my boy is taking for ADHD? Absolutely not. No connection whatsoever. New condition. Prescribed Zoloft, Paxil. Now, because these drugs sometimes produce manic effects, now the child is up and down and up and down and back to the psychiatrist, who now says, more accurate diagnosis now that I see the spread of symptoms is bipolar. Now we go to valproate, lithium, etc., drugs that have tremendously toxic side effects. So you see a pattern, a progression emerging of new diagnoses, new conditions, supposedly, and piling on of toxic drugs. What the public's main obstacle to understanding all these things is the following. People behave. People behave and think in all sorts of ways. People get sad. They get angry. They isolate themselves. They have problems. They suffer. They have pain. They live their lives. And one could take these patterns of thought, these emotions, these feelings, this suffering, and carve it up into various kinds of labels called mental disorders, and make a case that on the surface might be convincing that these disorders actually exist and that they stem from something happening in the brain. But in fact, when you actually examine a person who has serious problems, you begin to uncover in conversation, if you are adept enough and have an open mind, all sorts of causes. Could be exposure to environmental chemicals. Could be severe nutritional deficits. Could be abuse in the family. Could be the fact that no one has ever really listened to this person in their entire life. Could be a lot of things. Could be combinations of these. But in that case, what a real practitioner would do is try in every way possible to alleviate these factors that exist in that particular and unique human being without having to paste a label on that person's forehead with the name of a mental disorder. So there, in a nutshell, we have what we could call a psychiatric syndrome that applies to the practitioners, not the patients, that applies to the researchers, not the patients, that applies to the bureaucrats, not the patients. Now, again, all of this would be disturbing and tragic enough on its own, were it not for the fact that this field, this pseudoscience called psychiatry, is backed by the state, by the government, through licensure. Licenses are given out by boards, which are in turn certified by states. And you see that research facilities that run on tax money, which means federal money and state money and so on, like the National Institutes of Health and others, when it comes to people's, shall we call them, problems, that would be a very wide net, dole out huge sums of money for psychiatric research. That is not just favoritism. That is an attempt to establish a monopoly that is state-run and state-backed with enormous amounts of funds. And if you think that this may not be true, just try to obtain a grant from the National Institutes of Health for doing research on mental disorders on the basis that, say, nutritional protocols could resolve these without any sort of drug intervention, and see how far you get in obtaining grants and money. Yes, every once in a while one sneaks through, but it's like looking at one versus 10,000 on the side of conventional psychiatric research. And if you were going to go even further afield and say, for example, that you had evidence that you wanted to test in a study that exposure to environmental chemicals like the herbicide Roundup, for example, could be implicated in all of the symptomology of 1, 2, 3, 4 previously accepted mental disorders, and see how far you get in obtaining grant monies. No go. Absolutely no go. So this now becomes a psychiatric state. The monopoly on quote, mental problems falls under primarily psychiatry. Now, psychiatry states that mental disorders are the result of a chemical imbalance in the brain. That's sort of the cover story or the overall motto broadcast through many a media outlet in many research facilities to committees and politicians whenever they need to be told what the score is, as if this has been established as fact. But as Dr. Bragan has proven on many occasions, there isn't even an established baseline for, quote, normal brain activity. Therefore, how is one going to say, A, that a particular mental disorder is the result of a chemical imbalance in the brain, and then how is one going to go from there to say that it is a particular imbalance that can be pinpointed for all patients who are correctly diagnosed with mental disorder ABC? Can't happen. Won't happen. This is not, the chemical imbalance statement is not a research conclusion. It's a PR statement. It's a piece of everybody knows type promotion. But the closer you look, the more falsehood you discover. So that is yet another piece to the puzzle. Now, one of the issues that I wanted to discuss with Peter today is the cultural spillover from psychiatry, from all of this mental disordering that's going on. And that is under the heading of states of mind. These days, more and more people in the general public are walking around on the street believing that they are just short a diagnosis in discovering not only what mental disorder they have, but therefore what state of mind they are in.
John, hello.
Peter, hi.
Well, first, thank you very, very much. I ran into folks an unexpected, you know, I've never missed or been late for a show before, other than when I planned way in advance. This first time, and I won't trouble you all with why I couldn't be here, but it was such a relief to know that John Rappaport was my guest. Did you tell him you were planning to interview me, John?
Yes, I did, Peter.
And what have you been talking about before we go to break in a couple of minutes?
Well, I was just kind of giving a basic rundown on the pseudoscience of psychiatry, and I was quoting Dr. Russell Barkley, who says, a disorder doesn't have to have a blood test to be valid. If that were the case, all mental disorders would be invalid. There is no lab test for any mental disorder right now in our science that doesn't make them invalid. And so I began from there saying, indeed, that makes them absolutely invalid.
And that is a great quote. I've never heard that. That's a marvelous quote.
Comes from a PBS special called Does ADHD Exist?
Wow. Well, you know, there's just so much going on now that is books coming out. You know, we're not alone anymore. Lots of critiques coming out of ADHD. We've got about 2 minutes to go. Why don't you wrap up? And, folks, when we come back, John Rappaport's going to ask me things, but I'm also going to tell you about this marvelous conference I just came back for. We co-conference down in Florida with the Adlerians. I spoke to probably 250 people. We had a really marvelous weekend. And when we come back, I'll tell you about that. But, John, would you just like to wrap up for a minute or two?
Yes, it'll just take me a minute. The last point I was making was that more and more in the public mind, the idea of a diagnosis of a mental disorder defines, quote, the state of mind that you're in. So therefore, people believe that their state of mind is really defined by, shaped by, whatever mental disorder they have. And that is a very shrunken down and restricted view of one's capacity, potential, life, and so on and so forth. So that's part of the cultural spillover from the field of psychiatry. And that wraps up what I needed to say, so I'm happy to go to a break now with you, Peter.
Well, listen, I want to say you've got a good audience numbers going. I think you've helped people's interest. You've done a good job. I just want to say that John Rappaport is just a very important person to me. I don't think I would have done the Progressive Radio Network if I hadn't been on your show a few years ago. I may not have be a blogger on Natural News if it hadn't been for my reading you on Natural News. So, and now you've taken over and rescued my show for me. We'll go to break.
Okay,
thank you so much. And this is Dr. Peter Breggin with my guest, who promises to interview me in a few minutes. That was his idea. John Rappaport. I want to tell you about two things, just how well the concept of co-conferencing is going for us. Our Center for the Study of Empathic Therapy is reaching out to new groups by co-conferencing, which means that that I have equal input to some other organization that is co-conferencing with us, and that usually it's going to be in their territory where they can be right there to develop the venue. And that takes some pressure off of us to do long-distance planning and allows us to do more conferences and to integrate with other groups and bring in new kinds of folks. The Adlerian Conference of Florida in Tampa last weekend was just enormously successful. People enjoyed the folks I brought in, and I emceed all day, and the folks enjoyed the Adlerians, who were great people, including Frank Walton, who is a very, very active internationally in the Adlerians, and Tim and Jerry, my dear friends from Florida. So that's been really good. Now I want to announce for the first time, since that's done, a huge, marvelous conference we are planning for next year. This is worth putting on your calendar, April 17, 18, and 19. We're going to be at with Bert Caron, and we're going to be running a conference at Michigan State University on the campus. Michigan State University on the campus. It's got good access from airports. We're going to draw people from all over the world, as usual, but also a lot from the Midwest. So put it on your calendar, April 17, 18, and probably the 19th. It's a lovely hotel right on campus with a beautiful conference set up, and also less expensive hotels nearby. Right now, we're going to be giving about half a day. It's going to be a focus on really good people, not breakout sessions. The style here is going to be get to hear intensely about other people. One group that will probably get half a day is going to be the now getting to be really quite well-known open dialogue method of treatment that's been developed in Finland, where a person has their first psychotic episode, what would get labeled schizophrenia in this country. They intervene in the family, in the home, in unique ways, most often without medication, and they are literally obliterating the concept of schizophrenia in their area because they help people in the acute process get through it. So they're going to be there. Kevin Miller, who is the filmmaker of Generation RX, probably the best film in the field of medication in children. I'm sure it's the best film. And he is going to be showing his follow-up film, Letters from Generation RX, which will be out by then. You could be among the first to see it. And he's going to do a talk. And Bob Whitaker, if he's not outside the country, has said that he'll be coming when he knows his schedule for sure. Bert Caron, one of the great American psychologists, psychologist of the year, for the American Psychological Association, and despite being right in the middle of the establishment, a brave supporter of psychiatric reform, author of a book, the book on the psychotherapy of schizophrenia. So we're going to have some really intense, really looks at how you help people. I'll be there doing a critique of psychiatry, and if Whitaker's there, he'll do it some too. But we're going to be talking a lot more about frontiers of helping people. And again, it's going to be unique in how we focus on a few major approaches and programs to really give you the opportunity to better get to know me and Bob Whitaker and the program from Finland, the Open Dialogue program, and Bert Caron. And we'll have a few others coming as well. So, John, doesn't that sound like a great program?
Terrific, absolutely.
Yeah, I think it's going to be really, really exciting. We've got about 20 minutes left, 22 minutes left. Did you really want to ask me a few poignant questions?
I don't know how poignant they are, but absolutely. You know, one of the things I've always wondered is, at what point in your education and training in the field of psychiatry did you start to look around and say, wait a minute, everybody else is thinking ABC and I'm thinking XYZ, something is really wrong here? Where did it start for you such that you didn't follow the tried and true road and began to look at your own profession and see what was really going on?
Well, as astonishing as it is, John, it was 60 years ago today.
Not oh, really?
Today, but 60 years ago this year, 2014, 1954, I'm a college student, a freshman at Harvard, and a friend says, hey, me and my brother, who was also at Harvard, he was a senior, I think, are starting a college volunteer program at the local state mental hospital. Why don't you come on out? Now, I wasn't even in a psychology program or a pre-med. I was in an honors program for American history and literature. I was headed straight for an academic career, most likely, perhaps the law, but most likely an academic career. And I went out to the mental hospital, and it was like my Uncle Dutch's description of liberating a Nazi extermination camp. It was so horrible. And I got really involved in that program. I ended up leading it for a couple of years. I actually developed the idea for a book that we eventually published out of the program. I talked around at big conferences in the East about the program. In those days, even though biological psychiatry was dominant, there was a psychosocial wing. There was community psychiatry, which was kind of a progressive psychiatry with a liberal left-wing approach. There was existential psychiatry, which talked about the meaning of life. There was psychoanalytic psychiatry. And there was a kind of a broad social psychiatry to go along with the community psychiatry. None of that exists anymore, or has any effect at least anymore. So I had a lot of support back then from these kinds of folks for the volunteer program. But, John, it was obvious to me from day one that the hospital was ruining human beings and there was no excuse for it. So right away I knew that something was desperately wrong, because what kind of profession would support a state mental hospital system that was practically indistinguishable from a an extermination camp, including high death rates and mutilations and tortures and experiments, and lobotomies and shock treatments. But I found out at the same time, when I developed the program into a part of it into a case aid program, where we were supervised by a social worker in a selected group, and about 15 of us worked with patients, that we were getting these patients out of the hospital. This is written up in chapter one and two of Toxic Psychiatry. So I knew from the beginning that the answers lay in people. I don't know why I intuitively knew that love is what really, really heals people. But I knew that. I didn't have a background to know that. I didn't have a religious or spiritual background at all. So it's a very secular Jewish background. So it just was obvious to me from the beginning. What I didn't know until I finished my training, or really until I took the Harvard part of my training in psychiatry, what I didn't know is that while I'd been going to medical school and also pre-med medical school, that psychiatry had completely abandoned any psychological, social pretenses at all, any community psychiatry pretenses, and had sold itself to the drug companies. And that began to happen because psychiatry saw it as the only way it could survive. So by the time I'm finished my training, and I've taken 2 years at the National Institute of Mental Health, which puts us into 1968. It's apparent to me that psychiatry has no place for a reformer, and I went into private practice. Then I found out lobotomy was coming back, and I decided I was going to have to be a reformer from the outside. I had no idea the opposition there would be to something as obviously wrong as lobotomy coming back. So that's sort of the brief history. I knew from the beginning because I came in untrained. By the time I'm a sophomore in college, I'm running a big volunteer program, and I'm just getting to know psychiatrists, you know, and working with them.
Well, I think you put your finger on it. The fact that you are untrained, you weren't looking through some sort of hyper-medical filter at these people in the state institution. You were just looking at them as human beings. You weren't filled with all sorts of theoretical concepts to analyze them and so forth. And so you were looking at what was in front of your face.
Yeah, very definitely. And while I was a literature major, history and literature, I'd done a lot of reading back in high school, starting with Plato and Aristotle. And then I had started reading Karen Horney and Freud. So I was imbued with a psychological viewpoint when I walked in. I've been reading Alfred Adler, who had a big influence on me. So I already had was somewhat imbued with a psychological viewpoint. And it was just obvious that what was being done was awful. I mean, in college, I remember reading all of this on my own, Walter Freeman's book on lobotomy. And it was so clear the man was a butcher, that he was a sadist, that he was chopping up people's brains and getting a giggle out of it. You could read between the lines and see the jokes he made and realize that this is not helping people. This is expressing the violent, sadictive, sadistic side of humanity. That's how I got started. But I can't tell you why I looked at the patients in the wards and said, there before the grace of God go I. I don't know why I knew they were no different from me, that they had just had greater misfortune than me. It was just something I knew.
And then when you would speak, you know, let's move ahead to when you were now practicing as a psychiatrist, and you would talk to colleagues about, you know, what you saw, what you thought, and so forth. What was, what kind of reaction did you get from them? What was their comeback?
Well, these are great questions. I actually had two totally different experiences. The first experience was I did my internship in State University of New York, upstate medical center in Syracuse. I went there. I was planning to try to get into a Harvard program in Boston, I had applied for internships in Boston. But I learned Tom Soss had published The Myth of Mental Illness in 1962. So I called them up, changed all my plans, and became one of their two mixed medicine and psychiatry interns. And around Thomas Soss, there were quite incredible people. The sociologist Ernie Becker was there. He would later get a Pulitzer Prize for some of his writing. And he was looking at schizophrenia as an existential condition. There were a number of people. There was a psychiatrist taught the history of psychiatry from a very Zazian viewpoint of that the mental illness was a myth, and you had to look at the conduct of people. And Zas, of course, was the master spokesman against involuntary treatment. So when I was there, I was just growing. Now, there were also biological psychiatrists there, but they didn't dominate, and we could debate and argue, and it was just a tremendously fertile intellectual ground, the most exciting intellectual ground I was ever in. But I felt, gee, I got to go back to Harvard. So I went and took my first year residency at Harvard, thinking I was going to enter a residency that was psychologically and family-oriented, because that's how it had been the year before, but they changed overnight. See, psychiatry doesn't change on science, it changes on politics. Overnight, they decided to become a biological training program. So they either got rid of the analysts and the family therapists, or they actually limited the time you could have with them. I was forbidden to have more than one psychological, psychoanalytic supervisor. And I ended up bootlegging two or three because they had these great old-time people there who they were trying to shove out. But when I talked with the residents and the people in the new program, they wanted to destroy me. I mean, the things I was saying to them were so threatening to their very identity. For example, if you had a suicide attempt on your ward, which would have been very unusual at the Upstate Medical Center, because it was very humanistic and caring, you'd do a real analysis of what went wrong on the ward. Why did this happen? So when I had repeated suicide attempts around me, not my patients, I've never had a patient, do a suicide attempt, but once in the last 30 years or so, and I've never lost a patient, I never had a problem with that when I was in my training with very, very severe patients. But at Harvard, it was so competitive. The young residents were so out of touch with being human beings. They were just, you know, people had straight A's in chemistry and stuff, that patients were making suicide attempts all the time. So I brought up that this might have something to do with our ward milieu and what was going on around the patients, that it wasn't just the patients, because I said it was not like this at the State University of New York, where we had at that time, no longer, by the way, but at that time, a really good environment. Well, I mean, you know, I mean, it was like the devil had walked in. They didn't want to hear about this. Their only idea was that they were okay and the patients weren't. That was their philosophy. Not, I'm okay, you're okay, I'm okay, I'm even better than okay, and you're inferior. At one point, I went to a group therapy that wasn't required, but it was like a group therapy seminar you could go to. And there was all this talk among the residents about, it's so interesting, John, all this talk among the young psychiatric residents about how this wasn't a therapy session, a therapy group, that they didn't need therapy. So I said to them, my gosh, if you think that you're embarrassed to be in a therapy group, what does it mean about you being therapists? What does it mean how you view your patients? Are they shameful? The response was so violent, I decided not to go back.
Oh, wow.
So that's some of my early career that I probably haven't talked about, maybe ever, certainly not a long, long time. It's really important for folks to know that the whole biologizing of psychiatry, nothing to do with science. It was a political decision that's where the money was. That's where the power was. In fact, I knew these men because I had worked with the Harvard people when I was running the volunteer program. And I knew Jerry Clareman, who was the director of training now. I'd known him when he was a resident because he's somebody I met working in the program. I'd go over to Harvard and we'd talk about the program, even though it was in State Hospital. And Jerry, when I arrived, said, what are you interested in, Peter? I said, well, I want to continue to work on personality theory and therapy and how to help people and stuff like that. He said, that's dead, Peter. The future of psychiatry is drugs and computer diagnosis.
Wow.
And that's 1963. So, I mean, it was by fiat that the changes took place. It wasn't by science. And Harvard being the cutting edge, being the most probably involved with the drug companies early on, was just ahead of the other places in becoming totally biologic. Interesting stuff.
Interesting indeed. Very, very interesting. And
so... It was bizarre, John, to see these young Harvard psychiatry residents had spent all of their college in labs and all of their medical students having to be in the top few members of their class so they could get to Harvard. I got to Harvard on the basis of being a pretty good student, but not one or two in my class or anything like that. I was in the top third at Harvard. But I got in because of this volunteer program. I was already publishing in medical school or, you know, doing stuff that would end up being published. So, but these people couldn't relate to anyone. They couldn't relate to each other. They were utterly lacking in empathy. They had been brought up on the basis that they're in competition with the other students. If other students fail, they have a greater chance of moving ahead and going to Harvard Medical School and then the Harvard residency program. And they're trying to relate to some of the most disturbed and damaged human beings on earth who are being admitted to Harvard's acute psychiatric center. They didn't know what to do. One of them got so frightened by an aggressive patient in the middle of the night that he gave him shock treatment.
Wow.
I mean, that's extreme abuse. They drugged all their patients happily. They had no idea of sitting with a disturbed human being. And when I would come on the ward, say I'd be on duty at night, all the patients would come out of their rooms and want to sit around with me and talk. You know, we enjoyed talking together. They'd ask me questions. I'd give them as honest answers as I could. And then in the morning, they want me for their psychiatrist, you know. So I was, quote, manipulating patients my young residents accused me of. Now, my supervisors loved me because they were still old school.
Hmm.
I got along wonderfully. John Mack, who got off into some wild things later in his life about extraterrestrials. John Mack was my supervisor, you know, as an assistant professor or whatever he was, or associate professor at the time. I got along with him beautifully. I got along beautifully with my supervisors who were delighted to have a student who cared about his patients and wanted to treat him. In fact, I was so in such a different place that they had to supervise me alone because I was working on such a different level than the other students who they might want to supervise in a group of two or three. So I had great experiences with the old-time professors, including fairly young John Mack, who was very sensitive and caring, but the students were the new generation at Harvard, and boy, they were just not nice people. They didn't know what to do with themselves and other people. Boy, I'm talking away here. I'm getting interviewed, folks.
I'm listening. It's great. I really, the picture is so clear. And I can tell you, because I was in college back in the late 50s in New England, on the other side of the state from Harvard, but I was seeing pre-med students. You know, they were the ones who were in the library until 3 in the morning in little booths, 7 days a week, cut off from a lot of human relations because, you know, the science courses were piled on their heads and they just had to study all the time. And so when they said, I want to be a doctor or I want to be a psychiatrist, a lot of them had no clue what that really meant, just as you've described. It was all about getting the good grades, the competition. And I'm sure that some of them, when they first actually sat across from a patient later on, you know, went into deep shock because they had no clue what to do, nor that this would be their future. They were just removed from the rest of humanity.
Yes, and think about the fact, who are they trying to help in their first year residency? They're trying to help people who are hallucinating, completely out of touch, aggressive, disturbed. They're trying to help people who the local psychiatrist had to send into the hospital right from the get-go. They're getting the idea you can't talk to mental patients because, indeed, they can't.
Right.
They don't have any idea that these people are just like themselves, only they're the uptight version of these people, or the obviously, you know, stressed version. They're just the uptight version of what they're looking at.
Exactly.
I've never said that before, but boy, was that true.
We're winding down to the end of this, Peter.
We got about 3 or 4 minutes, I think. I'll get a 2-minute warning any minute now.
Okay.
And I just got my 2-minute warning. I'm back here, folks. I'm Skyping with the engineer, and we're instant messaging. This is what we do. And I came in to do that when I joined in half an hour. I can't say enough, folks, about John Rappaport. I mean, you're talking to a man who is extraordinarily intelligent, writes beautifully, has understood psychiatry from the get-go. Do you want to say in 1 minute, or just about 1 minute, how you got so on target with psychiatry so way back?
Well, I read Toxic Psychiatry.
That was the confirming blow.
You know, when I read your book, it just lined up so beautifully with other research that I had been doing on the toxicity of medical drugs that were not psychiatric drugs. And then, you know, from there, it wasn't very difficult to begin to see, well, what about the diagnosis? Because I had been through that with other so-called diseases that were turned out not to be diseases. An epidemic in Japan that was really caused by a gastrointestinal drug, and they were looking for viruses for years, and people were having neurological collapses from taking this drug. And so I was on to the idea, well, just because they call it a disease doesn't necessarily mean it is. And then when I read Toxic Psychiatry and I talked to you, then it all just clicked into place, and I said, wow, this has got to be the biggest scam I've ever come across. So from there, it was pretty easy.
Thank you so much, John. It's just been a lifesaver for having you take over the first half of the show and interview me for the second half. I think people would benefit from having you come in and just talk with me periodically, and I just much appreciate you being there for me today.
Thank you so much, Peter. I really enjoyed it, as always.
So, did you give them your website?
www.nomorefakenews.com. That's it.
nomorefakenews.com. Thank you, John Rappaport.